Well, we're going to continue this morning on our study, if you would, of the man Elisha. So if you'd like to open your Bibles, if you brought them with you this morning, we're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 4. And just to give you a little bit of background or reminder as to where we are, there were two prophets in the Old Testament with very similar names. One was Elijah, and the other one was Elisha. And the one followed immediately after the other. And if you remember, the prophet Elijah was taken up into heaven, and the mantle was passed to Elisha to carry on the ministry. But you also remember that we kind of compared and contrasted the ministry of these two men. And the ministry of Elijah was more a ministry of judgment and of calling down God's wrath upon those who had departed from the worship of Yahweh. Whereas the ministry of Elisha was more a ministry of healing, a ministry of redemption. If you notice also, Elijah's ministry was more of a public ministry. It was the things that he did, the miraculous events that surrounded his ministry, were more in the open and in public and very dramatic. Whereas Elisha, his ministry, more of the miraculous events that surrounded his ministry were done on an individual or with small groups, and were done more privately. Now, that's not to say that they didn't each have a little bit of both, because you remember the last time we spoke, we talked about the army of Israel and how they dug the trenches in the valley and they were filled with water, and God's victory was demonstrated for the whole nation of Israel and Judah. So it's not as though Elisha's always in the closet with regard to his miraculous events. And the two that we're going to look at today in the life of Elisha are very parallel to two that took place also in the life of Elijah. And they were very private and personal miracles, if you would. And if you have some time this week, I challenge you to go back and to 2 Kings chapter 17, or excuse me, 1 Kings chapter 17, and you can read about those two particular incidences in Elijah's ministry. But this morning we're going to focus on those of Elisha. So we pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 4. Now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." Then he said, "Go borrow vessels at large for yourself from all of your neighbors, even empty vessels. Do not get a few. And you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons, and pour out into all those vessels, and you shall set aside what is full." So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons. They were bringing the vessels to her, and she poured. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "There is not one vessel more." Then the oil stopped. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons can live on the rest." I really enjoy going to the Old Testament, because you have, and I hesitate to call these stories, because the writer tries to help us to see them as real events. You know, if you were just going to report this and you know, matter-of-factly, you would have gone to some, you know, you could have shortened it to maybe two verses and talked about, you know, there was a widow that needed money, so Elisha told her, fill up these vessels with oil and go and sell it. But instead, I think the writer puts a little more emotion into it. And I think the reason for that is so that we can participate in it, if you would. So that we can feel the emotion of what's going on here. Just words like, now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha. She was in a desperate situation. She didn't just come to Elisha and say, oh, by the way, you think you could help me out here? That's not the emotion of the passage. She cried out in agony, help me. It's desperate. Of course, none of us have ever experienced desperate situations, have we? In which we cry out for help. It's just not socially acceptable to do that kind of thing, is it? And yet, here is a woman who needs help and doesn't see any way out of her situation. And so she goes to the one person that she believes can find her help. It describes her as one of the wives of the sons of the prophets. And if you remember, the sons of the prophets were, and there were probably more than one of these groups, but they were groups of men who had devoted themselves to the service of the Lord. And if you remember back in the days of Elijah, and you remember the man Obadiah and how he would hide the prophets, and he would provide for them in caves because Jezebel was seeking to kill them. Well, these are the same groups of people that were in various cities. There was probably a group in Bethel. There was probably a group in Jericho and one in Gilgal. But anyway, this was a particular woman. You know, whether it's true or not, some of the old rabbinical writers believe that maybe this might have even been the wife of Obadiah, which would explain why she was in such desperate financial need, that she or her husband had spent all of his finances taking care of hiding the prophets and providing for them. And when he died, he left her rather destitute. And apparently there was some debt that was owed. And we can make the point here that obviously borrowing money was not a problem because Elisha did not rebuke this woman for this situation. He simply took it as a matter of fact and understood that what the situation was. But also understand that in the Old Testament, it was legal, it was okay by the law for a person to take a person who owed a debt that couldn't pay that debt, to take them and not necessarily enslave them, but make them work such that they could pay off that debt. And that would also include that person's children. Now, there was a thing called the Year of Jubilee, which occurred every 50 years. And every debt was considered absolved on the Year of Jubilee. And so these debts, or when a person was taken and made to work to pay off a debt in the Year of Jubilee, they would be set free from that debt. So this is not an unusual situation. This is not something that would not have normally happened in the course of their culture, that a person would come and require that person or that person's children to become workers. However, the fact that it uses the word slaves may indicate that there was some abuse of that liberality. That in fact, where the law allowed for them to be treated as hired people or hired men to pay their debt off, this actually says that they were going to make them slaves, which that was a particularly prohibited in the law, that they were not to be made slaves, that they did not impress their own countrymen, their own brothers, into slavery to pay a debt, but that they were to show compassion to a degree to their own countrymen. So what is Elisha's response to her? He asks her, "What shall I do for you?" Okay, you've got a creditor that's coming. He wants his money. He's going to take your children as slaves. What am I supposed to do? And I often wonder as I read these passages, did God give Elisha the solution? Or did God simply tell him what to do and then God unfolded it as the event went on? It doesn't really tell us, and we don't really get a sense of that. But it's almost as though Elisha doesn't really know what's going to happen here, because he says, "Well, what shall I do for you?" And then he gets this idea. He says, "Oh, okay, so what do you have in your house? What can we sell to absolve this debt?" Well, unfortunately, apparently the only thing this woman had was a flask of oil. And I'm not sure what kind of oil it was, because there's several different kinds of oil that are mentioned in the Bible. If you remember the parable of the 10 virgins who had lamps, and five of the virgins were prudent, and they brought extra oil for their lamps so that when the bridegroom came in the middle of the night, they would have plenty of oil. The other five virgins were foolish and didn't bring enough oil, and so when the bridegroom came, they didn't have enough oil. And they went away to go find some, and when they came back, the bridegroom had already gone in for the feast, and they were left outside. So there's oil that would be used for lighting the house, put in a lamp. There was also, and we can refer back to Elijah's similar miracle with regard to the widow of Zarephath, where she had a little bit of flour and a little bit of oil, and she was going in and she was going to prepare the last meal for her and her children, and then they were going to die because there was a famine in the land. And we learned that Elijah said, "No, go ahead, make me a cake and make some for your children, and you know, bring me mine first." And we go on to read that the flour and the oil, which I'm assuming in this situation was cooking oil, basically was endless until the famine was over. So you have oil to light a lamp, you have oil to cook with, and there was also oil for anointing people. In the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles is replete with incidences where the prophets would go and they would anoint the new king with oil. So there's a different kind of oil, or maybe a different usage of oil. And for all I know, maybe it was all the same kind of oil, it just had different usages. But in this case, all she had was a small flask of oil, presumably very little oil left in the flask. And so she told Elisha, "That's all I have. That's all the possessions in the world that I have of any value." Then he said, "Go borrow vessels at large for yourself from all your neighbors." In the original text, it's much more dramatic. It's go and beg from your neighbors all of the empty vessels, all of the empty containers that they have. And he says, "Do not get a few." it didn't specify, you know, go get 100 vessels, go get 1,000 vessels, go get 50, go get 10. But he left it up to her to decide how great her need was. Ever think about that? You know, if someone says, go get me some of this, but don't get just a few. What are you going to do? You remember the guy that was told to smack the arrows on the ground and that was the number of victories that he was going to get? And it was Elisha that was the prophet in this situation. And someday maybe we'll get to that story. But Elisha was angry with him because he smacked the ground 3 times. And I guess that's all he thought he needed was 3 victories. So he tells the woman, go and get not a few vessels. So she goes and she gets them. And he tells her that you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons, pour out into all these vessels, and you shall set aside what is full. So the idea here is that we are not going to make a public spectacle of this. This is something between you and God is going to perform it. You know, and oftentimes, you know, we talk about the miracles of Jesus. You know, Jesus would touch someone and they would be healed. Jesus walked on water. Jesus calmed the sea. Jesus caused the fish nets to be full to the point they tore. But is this really Elisha performing anything here? Or is this simply God using Elisha to guide this woman to do what he has prescribed to do so that he can meet her needs? And, you know, if it were not recorded here in Scripture, how would we know this ever happened? And I don't know of, you know, did her neighbors know what she was going to do? We're not told. But the idea here is that God is going to meet her needs on a very personal level. And he's going to show her and her children his ability to meet their needs. So she went in from him and shut the door behind her and her sons. And they were bringing the vessels to her and she poured. And the idea is that they kind of had an assembly line here going. One child would bring her an empty vessel and she would pour and hand it to the other child and he would set it aside and they would just, and it just kept going and the oil just kept coming out of the flask. And I don't know about you, but I like to imagine myself in that situation. When I read stories like this, how would I react to this? You know, when I pick that thing up and I'd say, how is this doing this? How can it just keep? Because there was just a little bit in there to start with. How does it? And then as she's filling more and more and more, does she start getting greedy and thinking, oh man, we could live forever on this oil. And what happens? When the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is not one vessel more. We filled them all up, Mom. And what does it say? The oil stopped. In the original language, it actually says, and the oil stood up. There wasn't any more. It wouldn't come out anymore. God provided exactly what she needed. And he provided oil to fill every vessel that she was able to procure. So now she's got a house full of oil vessels. What am I going to do with these? So she came and told the man of God, and he said to her, go sell the oil and pay your debt. And you and your sons can live on the rest. So we have to presume that not only did God provide sufficient oil for her to pay her debt, but also to meet her needs going forward. Now, whether that meant for the rest of her life or whether that meant her immediate needs, we're not really told. But we also know that You know, it's not, and it's not just the miracle that there was oil, but, you know, those of us who have tried to sell things, it's also the miracle of a buyer to purchase the thing that you want to sell. And sometimes that's almost a greater miracle. Right, Rod? Do you know that feeling too, Dave? Sometimes we can have what we think is a great idea, but unless it's God who blesses it and God who provides, and praise God that He provides in such a multitude of ways for each one of us, and He uses each one of our talents to allow us to provide for our families. In this case, it was He provided oil for this poor widow, for her to provide for her family. Well, we're going to try to get through this next one here. I like this one even better, so we'll try to push this through. Now, verse 8, it says, "Now there came a day when Elisha passed over to Shunem, where there was a prominent woman, and she persuaded him to eat food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat food. She said to her husband, 'Behold, now I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Please let us make a little walled up chamber, and let us set a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lamp stand. And it shall be that when he comes to us, that he can turn in there.' One day he came there and turned into the upper chamber and rested. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Call the Shunammite.' And when he had called her, he stood before her. He said to him, 'Say to her, behold, you have been careful for us with all this care. What can we do for you? Would you be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the army?' And she answered, 'I live among my own people.' So he said, 'What then is there to be done for her?' And Gehazi answered, 'Truly she has no son, and her husband is old.' He said, and this would be Elisha, he said, 'Call her.' When he had called her, she stood at the doorway. Then he said, 'At this season next year, you will embrace a son.' And she said, 'No, my lord, O man of God, do not lie to your maidservant.' The woman conceived and bore a son at that season the next year, as Elisha had said to her. When the child was grown, the day came that he went out to his father, to the reapers. He said to his father, 'My head, my head.' And he said to his servant, 'Carry him to his mother.' When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon and then died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. Then she called to her husband and said, 'Please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return.' He said, 'Why will you go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath.' And she said, 'It will be well.' Then she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, 'Drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you.' So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her at a distance, he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Behold, there is the Shunammite. Please run down and meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child?' And she answered, 'It is well.' When she came to the man of God, to the hill, she caught hold of his feet, and Gehazi came near to push her away. But the man of God said, 'Let her alone, for her soul is troubled within her, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me.' Then she said, Did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me?' Then he said to Gehazi, 'Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, do not salute him. And if anyone salutes you, do not answer him, and lay my staff on the lad's face.' The mother of the lad said, 'As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you.' And he arose and followed her. Then Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the lad's face. But there was no sound or response. So he returned to meet him and told him, 'The lad has not awakened.' When Elisha came into the house, behold, the lad was dead and lay on his bed. So he entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself on him, and the flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked in the house once back and forth and went up and stretched himself on him. And the lad sneezed 7 times and the lad opened his eyes. He called Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her. And when she came in to him, he said, "Take up your son." Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground. And she took up her son and went out. Once again, this is a very similar account of Elijah's raising from the dead the widow of Zarephath. There are some distinct differences here. But I think the fact that they both participated in this kind of miraculous event was God's way of testifying of their ministry and His and God's hand in their ministry. You can read through the Old Testament. I mean, you can look at the New Testament, and there are many examples of Jesus raising people from the dead. In fact, there's examples of Jesus not even being there and he commands that someone be raised from the dead. We see the apostles raising people from the dead. But the Old Testament is not really, there are not plentiful accounts of people being raised from the dead. That was not something that just any old prophet could do in those days. And I think there was, in this period of time, and if you remember what the period was, it was a time in which it was after David and after Solomon, and the nation had been torn in two, and there were evil kings reigning, and there was the worship of idols was being promoted, and there was wickedness running rampant in the country. And God has called His prophets to minister and to preach against those things, and He wants them to have the credentials that are necessary for the people to know that these men are of God. And even though this was a very private miracle in the sense that, you know, nobody really knew about it, there is a sense in which Elisha's fame was going to precede him, and we'll see later on, not sure how soon, as we progress through Elisha's ministry, we will see that God uses these miracles to allow people even outside of the nation of Israel to know that God is using Elisha to do great things. Basically, what we see here is a woman practicing hospitality sees this guy, he's traveling. And you know, one of the things that they were told to do in the law was when there was a sojourner, when there was a traveler that came through, it was your responsibility to put them up, to take care of them, to give them a place to stay and to feed them. And so this woman was probably just exercising what was her, if you would, biblical duty to offer him a place to stay and food to eat. And it came to the point where he came through there frequently, and she got to know him a little bit. And how does she describe him to her husband? "Behold, now I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually." She noticed something about Elisha as he was traveling back and forth to wherever he was going to minister. And one commentary I read said that this is the only place in the Old Testament that a prophet is referred to as a holy man of God. There was something distinctly different about the man Elisha. And so she said, let's make us a little, make a little guest room for him, because he's coming through here quite frequently. That way he'll feel comfortable. He can just go in there and rest if he needs to, or whatever he needs to do. And so they build him this little room. And so what's Elisha's response to this? Man, this woman has been really kind to us. How does he put it? He says, "You have been careful for us with all this care." It's kind of a repetitious statement. It's intended to provide emphasis. But it's the idea that she was very diligent in taking care of his needs. And so he felt like, there's something we ought to be able to give this woman. And he asks, "Would you be spoken for to the king or the captain of the army?" That might seem like a rather strange request, but basically, are you having any legal problems? Are you having any issues with the government that, maybe I could work on for you? And her response is no, basically. "I live among my own people. I'm comfortable here." And what does it say about her? Back in verse 8, it calls her a prominent woman. So she's not in a situation where she needs help. She's a prominent woman. She obviously is a wealthy woman because she has servants. Her husband's out in the field working. And so he's like, okay, so what do we do for her? And Gehazi, which I believe this is the first time we've been introduced to him, he is kind of Elisha's servant or right-hand man. He goes with him and ministers to Elisha's needs and does his bidding sometimes. And Gehazi has noticed that apparently she's younger than her husband, because it refers to her husband as being old, but not her being old, and says that she doesn't have a son. She has no children. And you're thinking, well, okay, so she doesn't have any children. Well, in that culture at that time, not having children could be very devastating, because if your husband dies, and apparently he was much older than her, which was a very likely occurrence, then she would be left with no one to provide for her. And even though she may be wealthy now, it would require a lot of money to manage whatever her husband had left her. She would be vulnerable and without any children to take care of her. Then one commentary made the mention that children were the equivalent of Social Security in that day. That's who took care of mom and dad when they grew old. And so this seemed to Elisha to be, this is a great idea. To Elisha, this seemed to be a great idea. So he called her and he said, "At this season next year, you'll have a child." I don't know about you, but I forget. I mean, this is the prophet Elisha. He's parted the waters of the Jordan. He's caused an oil flask to flow until all these vessels were full. He's been the instrument that God used to fill the trenches in the valley. He's had his fair share of being involved in miraculous events, but to tell a woman who's barren and has had no children to this point that she was going to have a child next year by this time, that's a pretty big step, I think. I mean, he's obviously got absolutely no control over whether this happens or not. And yet he apparently, by the authority of God, makes this pronouncement. And what's the woman's response? Unless you think that she is exercising a lack of faith here, I think it's probably more that she is so ecstatic with the idea that she would actually have a child and so thrilled with it. And yet there's that fear in that, you know, don't get my hopes up if this really isn't going to happen. But she's thrilled that this could possibly happen. And so the woman conceives and bears a son. But that's not the end of the story, is it? God's not done here. You know, and isn't that the way God always does things? There's always another chapter. And so the son grows up and goes out in the field. He complains of a severe headache. And, you know, we can only guess as to what the problem was. Was it an aneurysm? Was it heat stroke? We don't know. But they carry the child back to the house, and he lies on his mother's lap till about noon, and then he dies. Now, once again, it's, you know, this is an account in the Old Testament in which the writer is trying to draw us in to the emotion of the situation. Here's a woman that's been childless. She's finally got a child. It's grown up. You know, her dream has been fulfilled, and now one simple incident, and that's all been taken away from her. It's gone. It's over. My son is dead. I've held him as a baby. I've nurtured him. I've cared for him. And I even held him in my lap in his dying moments, and now life has left his body. Can we imagine the emotion? And I think some of us can, because some of us have been through situations like this. So what does she do? She takes the boy's body and she lays him on the bed that they had made for Elisha. And she goes to her husband to procure some transportation. And apparently it wasn't unusual for this woman to go and see Elisha, because her husband is not alarmed at the fact that she's going to see Elisha. It's just the timing that she is going to see Elisha. So apparently there were times when she would go and visit him. And he says, "Why are you going now? It's not a religious festival. There's nothing going on." And what is her response? In the original language, it's the word shalom. And how many of us know what that means? It's kind of a greeting, isn't it? It's just a hi, bye. I mean, it's a general purpose word. And so they translate it here, it will be well. Or you could just translate it well. Or I read one commentary, it said, never mind. Just, you know, I'm going. Don't mind about me. Just, we're, you know, this is just a little thing. So she saddles the donkey and she says to her servant, "Keep this donkey moving as fast as you can keep it moving, unless I tell you to slow down." And so she comes to the man of God at Mount Carmel. He sees her coming off in the distance, and so he sends his servant to find out because apparently Elisha is probably smart enough to know that it's not a new moon or a Sabbath. So why is this woman coming to me? And so he sends Gehazi down to find out what the problem is. And he says, "Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child?" And she responds again with shalom and runs right on by him and comes to the man of God and falls at his feet and grabs his feet. And Gehazi, of course, is running right behind him, and he's ready to push this. What should I say? Irreverent woman off the feet of Elisha. And Elisha says, "No, something's going on here. And I don't know what it is, because God hasn't revealed it to me. But this woman is in torment. And we need to find out what's going on. But you notice she doesn't tell him what happened. She only hints at what happens. She says, "Lord, did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'?" She doesn't come right out and say, "The son that you promised me, that grew up, that I nurtured, that I took care of, that you promised, that fulfilled my dreams, has died." No, she doesn't say that. And whether it's because she's so wrought with emotion that she can't bring herself to say it, or what the situation is, but she kind of accuses Elisha, doesn't she? But I think Elisha has got enough compassion that he understands, and he immediately knows what's happened. Because what does he do? He says, "Gehazi, gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. Don't talk to anybody on the way. Because apparently in that culture, if you stopped and said hi, it could turn into a very prolonged conversation. I don't want you to be interrupted in this particular mission. So whether it's rude or not, you get there, and you get there as fast as you can. And when you get there, lay my staff on the lad's face." Now, it doesn't tell us what anybody expected that to do. And the consensus is that Elisha actually did this to show people, Gehazi, the servants maybe that were in the house, maybe even the lad's mother, that it wasn't Elisha's stuff that could create a miracle. It wasn't his staff. It wasn't his servant. It wasn't, you know, that it wasn't a magical incantation that would do anything for the child. And the mother expresses that she doesn't believe it's going to do anything either, because she says, "As the Lord lives and as I live and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So he arose and followed her. Then Gehazi passed before them and laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was no sound or response. So he returned to meet him and told him, "The lad has not awakened." Elisha doesn't say anything to Gehazi. He doesn't rebuke him. He doesn't say, "You know, well, what's the matter with you? Are you, you're such a man of little faith. Why couldn't you raise this kid from the dead?" He simply goes into the house and sees the lad. He goes into the room and shuts the door. So it's just he and the lad. And he does something very similar to what Elijah did when he raised the widow of Zarephath's son. He lays on him. The child's body becomes warm. How long would that take? I mean, I don't know what the ambient temperature in that room was. But presumably that child's body would have lost some heat. I don't know how long the trip to get Elisha took. But presumably that body had begun to decay. That body had lost its body heat. This was probably not an easy thing for Elisha to do. And yet he had seen, or he had heard, how Elijah had done something similar. And obviously prompted by the Spirit of God, he lays there until the child's body is warm. I guess I neglected to point out one thing. Back in verse 32, after he shut the door, he prayed to the Lord. And now, after the child's body has become warm, he got up and he walked back and forth, presumably maybe to pray some more, to listen to God's leading. And then he returned and stretched himself again on the lad. And then the lad sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. He called Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her. And when she came into him, he said, "Take up your son." Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground and took up her son and went out. This is not the kind of event that happens on a daily basis for any of us here. It didn't even happen on a daily basis for Elisha. And it certainly didn't happen on a daily basis for this woman. And so these people's lives are forever changed because of this. Why couldn't God just have left it at the miracle of this woman having a baby? Let him grow up, let him provide for his mom, and let life just kind of go on. Why does God interject into these people's lives? And no doubt, there came the time when the woman had to explain to her husband what had happened. And the word went out. And surely there were those that scoffed and disbelieved. But for this woman, for her husband, for that household, and maybe even for Elisha himself, this is an event that God planned in order to change their lives. It was not a normal, everyday circumstance or event. And it wasn't Elisha doing it either, was it? Because what power could Elisha have to bring back life to a dead body? Sure, he could lay on it until it warmed up. But right there is evidence that he couldn't bring it back to life. But that it required God to bring it back to life. God puts events in every one of our lives. Events that we, when we're going through them, believe to be very tragic events. Very difficult events. And sometimes, especially when we're going through them, it's easy to say, "God, I don't understand. I don't know why you're doing this." And sometimes it doesn't turn out as well as it turned out here. But God takes those things and makes us into somebody different. Somebody that He wants us to be. Somebody that now has that experience that they can draw on to minister to somebody else that's going through that. And what it requires of us is that we believe that God is good and can do no wrong, and that He has the absolute best in mind for us, and that what He calls us to go through, He has a reason and a purpose for, and there will be benefit to it. But we must remain faithful to God. And as this woman showed, even in the end, when she bowed, it wasn't to worship Elisha. Because she knew it wasn't Elisha that did this. She knew it wasn't Elisha that had conceived that child in her. But she was worshiping God. And even as Job, when all was taken away from him, what did he do? His response was to worship. And that's what we need to learn. As we read through these stories, these accounts in the Old Testament of the experiences that God gives those people, we need to learn from them and then use those things that we learn as God takes us through those difficult times.
We're doing a study with the high school kids, and we've been really careful. It chronicles David's life, but we've called it a study about God in the life of David. And I think one of the things that a lot of times we do when we go to the Old Testament is that we are enamored by the people themselves. But what we need to do is look beyond that and say, what is God teaching me? What is God using Elisha to do here? Let's do a study about God in the life of Elisha. And in these two miracles, what is it that God, what is God doing? God is teaching these people faith. He's teaching these people to trust in Him. But He's also giving us an account of that, so that we have people that have gone before us. They could trust God. God proved Himself trustworthy to them. He is also trustworthy and faithful and steadfast for us, even today.